Hello, I'm Dick Strasser here with Stuart Molina, conductor of the Harrisburg Symphony, and we're getting ready to talk about the concert coming up at the end of January. That's about a week and a half from today's date, depending on when you're reading this on the blog, but it's a winter landscape program.
Well, it's a concert in winter.
That's true.
And actually, I suppose that that there are elements of the program that do evoke winter, kind of the stark and yet beautiful,
Anything Russian for one.
Yeah, exactly. It's a title, if nothing else. Yeah. It is a winter concert and a beautiful one.
Yeah, and you start off with a cityscape as opposed to a landscape, so we
have that.
And I do remember one performance of the Beethoven Violin Concerto in a January concert. It was 1984. We had a blizzard. We had no bassoons.
Yeah, we're not allowed to say that word in January. Not approaching a concert.
So we have good weather forecast for this concert.
Which is wonderful. Yeah, it actually should be a mild weekend. I don't know. There's something about the Beethoven Violin Concerto that that evokes winter months. I sometimes associate certain pieces with performances at certain times, and I don't know why that should be the case, but Beethoven somehow, this piece I like doing in the winters. We're doing Brahms' Second Symphony, which seems very much a spring symphony. You'll find these things again and again in my programming, and I wish I could explain it other than that. It just seems right.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something, I don't know, magisterial, I guess, about a work like the Beethoven Concerto.
Oh, it's one of the best works of any genre of all time.
Yeah, and the fact that it's a violin concerto, when you compare it to a lot of the other repertoire, which is designed to be fast and flashy, kind of. This is not one of those kind of works. It's actually a large-scale symphonic work.
It is a large-scale symphonic work, and yet I think it's probably one of the most perilous pieces for a violinist to play because it's so exposed all the time, and the issues of intonation, although they appear simple, when they go right, are so often wrong. And that's why in approaching a piece like this, I've been waiting to program it until I found the violinist that I wanted to do it with. And when Augustin Hadelijk played the Mozart Fifth Concerto with us, I guess it was two seasons ago, I immediately knew that this was the guy that I wanted to do Beethoven with here. And luckily he was interested and available, and I think it's going to be splendid.
I know I haven't heard him do anything else. He's recorded Haydn concertos with Naxos, and he did the Mozart Turkish here, which was a phenomenal performance. You usually don't think of a Mozart concerto as being, quote, phenomenal.
Oh, exactly, you know? And I remember when he performed that concerto, watching our violinists, and we have a section of tremendously talented violinists, just looking at him as though they had had the piece exposed to them for the first time. It was very exciting.
Oh, cool. So he's doing the Beethoven. I don't know where is he in his career with things. What's happened with him since he was here?
He's actually having a wonderful young career. Just very recently, in the last couple of months, he had a write up in the New Yorker magazine that was an unqualified rave for his playing, and it must have been at a Carnegie Hall performance that he gave. But he's having an amazing amount of not amazing. He's having an appropriate amount of success for someone that gifted.
And still young. I mean, he's
very young.
He's beyond a prodigy, but he's still not, quote, the mature.
Exactly. He won the Indianapolis competition several years back, and at that point he was the young prodigy, and now he's matured into the mature artist. And
maturity doesn't necessarily have to be age.
Exactly. I don't think that he's going to wane any time. What I love about Augustine's playing is that it never was about flashiness, although he has virtuosity to spare. It isn't about that. He uses what's necessary to present the piece, but it's always about bringing out the inner beauty of a work, about crafting music. He's a serious violinist. You don't see there are a lot of young prodigies who are out there playing Wieniawski and Paganini's and even Tchaikovsky, these very big flashy pieces. Augustine can play anything. And as I said, there aren't a lot of violinists that I want to hear play Mozart.
I was thinking when you were saying that may be the reason that he's successful with Mozart, whereas maybe somebody else isn't, because once you get beyond the technique and the flash of a virtuosic performance, what do you find?
Exactly.
Where do you go?
The Mozart concertos are beautiful, and there's no way, if you play all the notes in the right places, it's going to be a nice performance, just because the pieces are works of genius. But to surpass that and to get to a performance that's truly transcendental, and that's what it was. It was a performance of a piece that every violinist plays when they're studying, a piece that is such a part of the repertoire that it almost is banal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a warm up for the real stuff, like Mendelssohn and Tchaikovsky,
and he made it as it is the pinnacle of musical achievement, and that's an amazing achievement for a player, and so the same is true of the Beethoven, although everyone does not play the Beethoven because it is an extremely difficult piece. But it's such a center of the violin repertoire. It's been called the best violin concerto. In fact, it's been called the best concerto. Mm-hmm.
And yet it was a failure.
Like so many pieces, no one knew that it was good until after it was premiered.
Yeah, I mean, Beethoven wrote it in, what, 18... I'm not sure the exact date.
Sure
1806,
either.
Something like that, mm-hmm. early in the 19th century. And it wasn't until Joachim played it, I think, in the 40s.
And
people started taking it seriously.
And that I find very surprising.
Well,
I mean, now
be,
anything
with a player.
Well, anything with the word Beethoven now is considered to be part of that, the work of the member of the pantheon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the time, Beethoven, I guess, was a composer writing music, and every piece was judged as it came out. And, you know, who knows what the performance was like? Who knows anything like that?
Yeah.
And frankly, if I heard a mediocre performance of the Beethoven Concerto now, I wouldn't enjoy the experience.
Right.
And so Joachim obviously was a master, and someone who was a particularist about detail, so maybe he was the first to be able to take the piece as a performer seriously enough to bring it across.
Well, I think Franz Clement, the guy who premiered it, had a day on the final movement. And
yeah. It's just not a piece you can do like that.
Because it was so huge, they broke it up, and in between the second and third movement, he improvised the sonata on the violin to be held upside down. I mean, what can you do?
So there you have it, and it's true of a lot of pieces. They say the same about the first performance of the Ninth Symphony, which Beethoven conducted apparently very poorly, and it was not the unqualified success that, needless to say, it is every time it's performed now.
Yeah. One of the things with Augustin Hadlich, I've been, you know, Where does somebody like this come from? I mean, where does he get training like this and experience and to look into Beethoven? And
the happy and sad truth is that there are many, many, many talented young violinists. And I think what makes the difference between the ones who are going to be extremely good amateurs and the ones who are going to be good professionals and the ones who are going to be transcendental professionals is, first of all, the amount of focused work that they're willing to put in. And Augustine clearly is a very focused person, capable of really high-level practice, and innate gift. And I think he has an innate gift for understanding musical line. And with violin, I think that's the most important thing. Harmonic understanding is important. Understanding the larger scope of the work is important, and he has all of that. But what he has that really makes him special in my mind is an ability to very subtly shape a musical line to bring it life, so that you have a simple melody like da dums da 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 dum in the first movement of the Beethoven. It's just an arpeggio and a scale. And yet he's going to be able to make it into something magnificent. And that's a gift. There's no, where does it come from? You could say it comes from God. You could say it comes from the deepest greatness of humanity. However you want to look at it, it's something that you have innately or you don't.
Mm-hmm. The rest of the program, I mean, when you've got the Beethoven Violin Concerto, it seems like, you're opening with a piece by Jennifer Higdon.
Well, Jennifer wrote to us and she said, you know, you need to play my music more often because the last time you played a piece of mine, I was nominated for a Grammy Award that month, and same thing this time, so.
Right, and as a matter of fact, the percussion concerto that you did here
is nominated this year.
Is nominated, and she can't be at this performance because she's going to be in, I guess it's Los Angeles or wherever they're having the Grammys, because her percussion concerto recording with London is up for best composition.
It's fantastic, and deserved.
Jennifer
is, she's a great composer, she's a great person, she's a humble person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything that comes to Jennifer, I wish upon her, if it's positive. She just deserves it all. And I'm so happy to be doing another piece of hers. I What I love about doing Jennifer's work is that it makes sense. A lot of contemporary composers, even the ones who are capable of writing beautiful music, and there aren't many, you look at the score and it just seems like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. With Jennifer, it's not simple music, but it always is.
It's
sensical.
Yeah.
And this is a piece that's very sensical. It makes a lot of sense. It has a form. It has identifiable themes. It has a few different elements going at once, which makes sense. It's a cityscape, and like in a city, there are a lot of different things happening all at once, each that makes sense unto itself, but together creates this kind of organized cacophony.
Yeah, musical traffic patterns.
And that's what this like. You begin with kind of a fanfare, and the fanfare plays a role through the movement. Then you have busy music, you know, what I would call city music. If you go back to the movies of the 50s,
right.
Music like that, yeah. Very fast-moving scales in canon with themselves, and that would be the second element. And then you have kind of rhythmic punctuations. In this particular case, it's a long note followed by a short note. Da-da, 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 but happening in weird rhythmic combinations with each other. And she uses these three very simple elements to great advantage and creates what is actually the first movement of a larger symphony. But she specifies that these three movements were also intended as individual pieces. Right. And they work very nicely that way.
This one was the first movement, which is what you're doing, was designed as a concert opener.
Exactly.
Actually, I think for a run-out concert for the Atlanta Symphony. It's a musical portrait of Atlanta.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
And then the big slow movement, I can't remember the titles now, about the river,
mm-hmm.
Big, long, slow movement, and then this big, large-scale
yeah, very large last movement.
This is the
simplest and the most straightforward mm-hmm. Of the movements of the piece. But I also think it's a wonderful opener for a concert, as it is a wonderful opener for her symphony.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy again to be playing her music. I like her. I'm sorry she won't be here as much because it's exciting for the audience as because I enjoy her company personally.
And she's great. I should mention, for people who are listening to this podcast, a week before the Harrisburg Symphony Concert, it'll be January 23rd,
you'll
get a
concerts.
Chance to hear Jennifer Higdon on a more intimate scale with just four players.
And she will be there.
Orchestra, and she will be there. To talk about the piece is called Impressions, a string quartet that she wrote for the Cypress Quartet, as a response to the Debussy Quartet, which is also on the program. So if you hadn't had a chance to hear her when she was here for the Percussion Concerto, stop in with Market Square Concerts. It's at Temple of Shalom.
Yeah, it will be a wonderful concert.
And it's great. And then the following Saturday and Sunday, Cityscape with the Harrisburg Symphony and Beethoven and Rachmaninoff on the program,
it's a
too.
Jennifer Higdon month.
we always seem to do this. When she was here for the Percussion Concerto, the Lancaster Symphony
that's right.
was doing one of the Cityscape movements in their concert the same month.
That's right. That's absolutely
so
right.
That was
So she's been in Central Pennsylvania a lot in music and in person.
Right. And there are... she's just so incredibly busy. I mean, she recently had a violin concerto with Hilary Hahn that's been premiered.
Oh yeah, she's one of the most prolific composers of mm-hmm. her generation. And I admire that. She doesn't let up. She's having tremendous success.
She is constantly writing.
And it's all good.
And she's working on an opera now and all this sort of
God bless her. She's a brave woman.
Very, very busy. So then we have Three Dances by Sergei Rachmaninoff, which sounds like it should be something kind of light and easy to toss.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting title for this piece because it's as symphonic as any of his symphonies,
yeah.
and it's certainly of similar length to his symphonies. Maybe not the second, but almost as long as the third. There's so much of interest in the symphonic dances. I mean, on a historical level, the idea that he had taken this hiatus from composition, this is the last piece that he wrote.
Right.
But that all is unimportant. What's important is it's a piece of incredible charm, incredible drive, incredible
and still drama
impulse, greatly dramatic.
Yeah.
They say that he did initially have the intention of creating a ballet out of this piece.
Mm-hmm.
But that never came to fruition.
Trying to see that with a pit orchestra.
Yeah, exactly. And I think probably had the idea of a ballet to this piece really been a reality, it would have been a different piece, because
mm-hmm.
this is not a danceable work.
Right.
Maybe the second movement is, first movement, perhaps last movement is is I think a little bit too rhythmically crazy to bring off a dance. Although I'm not a choreographer, you never know. But what I do know is this is a piece that brings all of his immense gifts as a composer to bear, not just as a melodist, and we know his famous melodies from the symphonies and from the concertos, but also as an orchestrator. He was a brilliant orchestrator, one of the very best of all time. And so this is a piece that sparkles, that's colorful, it's kind of like a rainbow of musical expression. And it's symphonic dances, not in the sense of imagining peasants dancing in a circle, but symphonic dances in that they're dance-inspired, but symphonies.
And I think a lot of it is probably wistful because he had left Russia behind him with a revolution.
He wrote it in New York. He was on Long Island.
Right, and this was 1940.
40.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I there's a lot of looking back in this. I mean, he actually quotes something from his first symphony, which nobody would know because the piece had never been performed after.
Even
that,
more than that, he thought the parts had disappeared.
Yeah.
That the first symphony, he wrote this obviously just as a wistful reminder in his own mind that no one who heard the piece would know. And the end of this first movement is actually one of the most lovely parts of the whole piece, where suddenly out of this very intense, driven, I wouldn't say stormy, but certainly intense first movement, and then suddenly it opens up into this C major world of almost fantasy and flight.
It's kind of spine-tingling moment.
Yeah, it is. And he brings out, you know, bells and it's just lovely. And then in retrospect, now that we know the first symphony, and which was a disastrous failure, we can understand that perhaps he was bringing some closure to that episode, which clearly was a devastating episode in his life. And here he's like saying almost, okay, now I've seen it all. I'm at the end of my career, and I can close that chapter.
And I think he's also looking back to the days of Imperial Russia with the balls and
well,
and
this whole piece has that kind of feeling, although
very court.
It there does have this sense of court dances, but there's always with an edge. The second movement is a waltz, but it almost is more evocative of the valse triste, that kind of very sad, bittersweet, almost or a Mephisto waltz, where there's a devilish impulse to it, than the sense of a let's say a Strauss waltz or a Brahms waltz or even a Tchaikovsky waltz.
Had you mentioned Ravel's La Valse?
Or Ravel's La Valse, exactly the same kind of feeling as Ravel's La Valse. Yeah,
which was actually written on the verge of World War I. This is written on the verge of World War II. So maybe there's some kind of
An inner turmoil, perhaps, or a sense of that all is not well with the world, or the old order is going to be upset. I mean, that's what I see as La Valse, was we have the old world and what's going to be the new world, and the new world's going to be chaos compared to the order of the old world. Here I'm not so sure, because already the old world has been gone for a good 30 years.
Yeah.
But there is a sense of something's lurking that's wrong under the surface. And yet, these beautiful melodies and lush orchestrations, the way that he writes for the string section in the second movement is so incredibly lush, and very much along the lines of Ravel's orchestration, with these full string section chords in tight harmony, just on a moving line. Very, very beautiful.
And you mentioned the bells. I mean, I love his literal bells, but also bell-like orchestration that he has a lot with.
Absolutely. And then there's, you know, the obvious things that everyone talks about, the Dies Irae that he brings out, the Russian Orthodox chants that he includes in the last movement. But again, I see that all as incidental. You don't hear this piece and say, ah, he's brought the Dies Irae. It's not like the Symphonie Fantastique, or even like his own Rhapsody theme by Paganini, where it's so heavy-handed. Here, it's almost underhanded. You know, some people may not even notice, because the rhythm is so dun 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 dun. You know, it doesn't any longer sound like the Dies Irae, because it's not intoned in steady chimes.
And it's the sort of thing, I mean, he used it in everything, so it was like, I guess he felt obligated.
Yeah.
Like who was the cartoonist that used to include, was it Nina or something?
Hirschfeld.
Hirschfeld.
That's right. It's a signature.
You look for it everywhere.
Or Shostakovich with his four-letter acronym.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, maybe it was a signature for him, which brings up other questions like, why would he choose such a, you know, the day of terror as his
And also being Russian and Russian Orthodox, that it's also part of the Catholic liturgy. I've always wondered about
that.
That's
right.
You know, that it,
and
that
he was not a Catholic.
No.
But clearly this particular chant had great meaning to him. What it was, I don't know that he ever wrote about it, but it's clearly there quite a lot.
Which may also have something to do with that quote from the First Symphony, that nobody would understand why it's there if they even knew what it was. And so maybe it still has, you know, some kind of personal significance. Everything has a personal significance to the composer. Whether it gets beyond that to the audience is immaterial, really.
That's right.
Because the composer is always looking for something to, like, hang a hat on, you know, to get something going. And
absolutely. I mean, I remember in my previous life as in college when I was actually writing music, I would look for anything that I could use, and most of it was inside jokes with me and my closest friends that even they wouldn't get unless I explained it to them. But you know, but if it gives you something to spring off of, I suppose that it's a good thing. And the Dies Irae certainly provided a lot of really good stuff for Rachmaninoff, and some of his very best works were built around this chant. So clearly, there's some inspiration there.
Another thing too that I think about when I hear this piece. I mean, he went through a period of his life where obviously he was a pianist. That was his way of earning a living. He wrote the third piano concerto because it was going to buy him a car.
You know? That's a good reason.
I mean, he collected fancy cars too. So I mean, he was looking for something to do. So he would write a piece to bring in that money. But when he became a pianist primarily, he stopped writing. And then when he would compose, very often, like the Third Symphony was a failure. The Fourth Piano Concerto was a failure. He wasn't sure what the Paganini Rhapsody was going to do. That turned out to be one of his most popular pieces.
That's right.
But he wrote very little work. So I'm thinking that after the First Symphony was such a disaster and he stopped composing, he actually went to a psychiatrist to help him get over this writer's block. It was about 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And the guy supposedly hypnotized him and said, "You will write the great concerto." And he wrote the Second Piano Concerto, which of course turned
it's
his career around. So maybe there was some kind of fear of this as he was having problems with that he would say, he was in his 70s, I guess, when he wrote this piece. So you know, he figured he wasn't going to have much time left.
Well, and he had had, a 4-year break between the previous piece and this one.
Yeah.
He does write at the end, "Thanks be to the Lord," or something along those lines in the autograph. Whether he knew this was going to be his last work or whether this was the culmination in his mind, I don't know. But it certainly has that feeling.
But there's that you know, hiatus after the First Symphony and the hiatus after all these other pieces.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as composers often think themselves, but how do you know how other composers think, you know, is that there had to be some kind of going back, because he seems to be almost cherry-picking different things. I mean, I'm sure that if you looked, you could probably
find
other
lots of things. And maybe there is that he's almost going through a musical psychoanalysis of living through his past successes and failures.
You did the Third Symphony a few
I love the Third
That's
Symphony.
That's a great piece.
It's one of my favorite pieces, and in fact, I would say it's my favorite of his symphonies. I like the Second very, very much. But I think the Third has so much more interest, and it's weirder and
it's more modern.
And there are some gorgeous. I mean, the melodies in that piece are also absolutely stunning. It's not nearly as directly accessible as this piece, the Symphonic Dances, but I think they're cut out of the same mold. You have there's a maturity and a sense of, you know, I'm going to do my thing. I'm not going to necessarily follow what the audience wants of me. The Second Symphony has a sense of wanting to please all the time, and it does. It's a spectacular piece, but I think the Third is a masterful piece that is way underplayed, and a piece that I'd like to bring back in the upcoming years, because I think the audience it deserves to be part of the standard repertoire.
Another thing too, I was thinking that, you know, a symphony has so much baggage with it. I mean, if you're Russian, of course, then there's Tchaikovsky, but a symphony in general in the repertoire with Beethoven and Brahms and all these people treading behind him, you know, that maybe he felt that even though the symphonic part of the dances could have been a three-movement symphony, he didn't want to call it that to jinx it.
Well, that could very well
be
the case.
People would have expected too much.
Well, and the other thing is it doesn't really come across as a symphony.
Mm-hmm.
It's so rhythmically driven that it doesn't have, in the third symphony, he sticks to standard symphonic forms, sonata form, sonata rondo forms. In this piece, they're dances. They are dance forms, every one of them. There isn't a sense of development in any of the movements. It's very much ABA most of the time. And so I don't know if it would really be appropriate to call it a symphony. But symphonic dances does, in a sense, lighten it almost too much.
What does symphonic mean in this case? I mean, symphony orchestra is one thing, dances for a symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
But symphonic is also talking about the process.
Well, he originally was going to call it fantastic dances.
That's right, yeah.
And I think changing it to symphonic dances is a indication and a reminder that this is a piece with great scope. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the symphonic means, that it's a piece for a large orchestra. With all the orchestral colors that you can find from an orchestra.
Including a saxophone.
Including a saxophone, which he had never written before. And I just learned today that he had consulted with
Sigurd Rashin.
With Robert Russell Bennett.
Oh, okay.
About the writing for saxophone. Robert Russell Bennett, of course, had orchestrated Broadway shows and Richard Rodgers music. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to use the saxophone but didn't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I liked that story. But yeah, so he decides that he's going to use the full range of orchestral expression, and so he changed the name to symphonic dances. There is something fantastical about it, but I think that symphonic dances is a good title. I just feel that it almost lightens it too much. There is definitely a gravitas to this work that isn't captured by the title symphonic dances.
Yeah, well, it's a great program, and with good weather in the forecast for a winter concert.
I hope a lot of people come, because, again, I think it's going to be a memorable one. If anyone has, you know, I say this, I guess, a lot, but this has something for everybody. It's mm-hmm. got, you know, it's got a little bit of contemporary busyness. It's got one of the great pieces, almost rhapsodic, spectacular works of all time in the Beethoven concerto, and then it has a real showpiece for orchestra with mm-hmm. sounds, and there's nothing, I would say there's nothing remotely objectionable about the entire program, mm-hmm. and quite a lot of spectacularness. But more than that, I think that the opportunity to hear Augustin Hadelijk play the Beethoven concerto is one that must not be missed.
Right.
This is going to be one where people leave the hall and are like, wow, we just experienced something magnificent.
Well, it's great repertoire, and with an artist who's on his way,
exactly.
I guess, because it's...
Or there already.
Well, being there at that level of playing is one thing, but getting the recognition
he's getting there.
How many Itzhak Perlmans and Pinka Zukermans are there out there now? I mean,
well, and
we
you
talk
know,
about
I,
the current generation of young violinists.
I often wonder whether it's a boon or a problem to reach that level of notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
When you're Itzhak Perlman, you've reached an incredible level of performance, obviously, in artistry and technical ability and musicianship. And then what can you do when you're playing concerts every week, if not several concerts mm-hmm. every week? You lose the time to really focus on practice.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And I think that it takes the very rare artist to be able to maintain the level and the career. I don't know how often Augustin is playing. My guess is he's playing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he has not yet lost that edge, and I hope he never does.
I hope he never does, too.
Because it's what defines his greatness.
I will tell another story. When I was a college student back in the late 70s, I think it was, there was a young violinist who came in from Juilliard, played the Tchaikovsky concerto. It was spectacular. Woman in front of me was complaining, you know, Why are we not listening to Isaac Stern? Why are we listening to these young students? I mean, who ever heard of, and then she looks down at the program, who ever heard of Pinkas Zukerman anyway? You know, you never know.
Yeah. Well, and the reality of the world right now is that to hear those big name artists costs eight or nine times as much for the orchestra, and in many cases you get a better performance out of the hungry rising star. Mm-hmm. And I'll stand by every one of my selections for guest artists.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we've had a remarkable streak, and you know, listen, I did concerts with Josh Bell last summer, and they were mm-hmm. incredibly fun and incredibly wonderful. But I don't think you'll find a better performance than you're going to hear at the end of this month of the Beethoven Concerto.
Cool. Okay, so that's Saturday at 8:00, Sunday afternoon at 3:00 at the Forum in Harrisburg with the Harrisburg Symphony. Stuart Molina will be conducting, and enjoy the concert.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for listening, and thank you, Dick.
Thanks.